Hello, everyone. This is Steve Baker, sometimes known around the interwebs as the Pragmatic Constitutionalist. I'm very honored and very excited today to have as my guest FBI whistleblower Steve Friend. Steve is someone who's been making the rounds for the last few months since he came out as a whistleblower, specifically related to January 6 cases that he was being required to work. But he has a much bigger story than that, related to not only the reprisals from the agency itself, but also, as most of you that have been following me know, that I have my own unique FBI experience related to January 6th, but I also have the crossover experience of having recently been involved with a child trafficking case in Houston, which itself also has an FBI connection. And that was, in fact, his primary job there out of the Jacksonville field office there in Florida, was working in child exploitation, trafficking, pornography cases, which he was being pulled off of in order to execute these warrants in Florida against these particular January 6th defendants. And we'll get into all of that a little bit later. But before I bring Steve on, I do need to get my one commercial announcement out of the way. I don't have anything else to sell other than a membership and a subscription to our Locals community. Obviously, Locals is something that is free to subscribe to. You can subscribe to our TPC community on Locals free of charge. It's a read-only subscription in that regard. But in order to participate fully, engage in conversation with our other members, talk to me directly, and then, of course, to receive exclusive content that I don't put out anywhere else on the internet or any other social media platforms, you would need to subscribe as a supporting member. And for as little as $5 per month, you can do that. Or you can do a annual subscription, which gives you 2 months free for only $50. And for those of you who don't like to subscribe to anything else because you've already reached your subscription limits, if you do see that what we're doing here in terms of these investigations related to January 6th, related to child trafficking and other stories as well, if you can support us in that regard and you just want to do a one-time donation, you can do that also. The best way to sign on to that is through one of your device apps. Just go to your app store, download the Locals app, and then look for @TPC4USA. @TPC4USA. I actually think it's better to sign up through a browser. So either on one of your devices' browsers or on your computer, you can go to either thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, or the easier way now is to just go to tpc4usa.com, tpc4usa.com. That'll take you directly to the sign-up page, and you can execute either a free membership or you can become a supporting subscriber there or make a one-time donation, whichever you prefer. All right, let's do this. Let's bring agent Steve Friend onto the program here. Welcome, Steve. So glad to have you joining me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. This is great.
Yeah. So I want you to first of all, for those who are not familiar with your story, and I expect that we'll have a rather large viewership on this particular podcast. So a lot of new people will be joining us, both because they've never seen me before, but mainly because you're here and your story is an important story right now. So give me just a real quick background on yourself as it relates to your history with law enforcement and how you got into the FBI, when, and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I became a sworn police officer in the state of Georgia in January of 2009 is when I started the academy. I actually got my badge in May 2009, worked in the Savannah, Georgia area for about 4 years. And during that time applied to and was hired by the FBI, and then was shipped up to Quantico, Virginia as a new agent trainee in 2014 over the summer. I spent my 20 weeks there and then was assigned to the Sioux City Resident Agency, which was a satellite office for the Omaha Division, straight out of the academy, where I spent the first 7 years of my investigative career working on Indian reservations in Northeast Nebraska. And after doing my time there, you get what's an exit benefit because that's considered sort of a hardship within the Bureau, and I elected to take that and transfer to Daytona Beach, Florida with my family in the summer of 2021.
Now, is Daytona the actual location of the field office, or is it Jacksonville? What's the relationship there?
Yes, Jacksonville is the field office. So Daytona Beach is another one of the resident agencies. Jacksonville essentially controls northern and middle Florida. Florida is split between Jacksonville, Miami, and Tampa.
And what was your primary job description, for to put it in layman's terms, while you were in Jacksonville, Daytona?
Yeah. So I took the transfer with the understanding that I was going to be investigating violent crime against children, essentially child pornography cases, as well as some human trafficking. But that changed shortly after the fiscal year ended in September and rolled into October of 2021. And that was when a call came in from, at that time, one of the assistant special agents in charge. And he said that I was going to be reassigned to work on the Joint Terrorism Task Force in my office, with being the domestic terrorism being my focus. And that child pornography cases were going to be considered a local matter going forward and not going to be resourced.
And the fiscal year, in FBI terms, is not January 1st. So this was after January 6th event took place. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. This was in essentially October 1 of 2021. So would have been 9 months approximately after January 6th.
I'm going to jump forward just by pure curiosity on my behalf. I was and have been very involved in tracking the case of Oathkeeper Ken Harrelson out of Titusville. Now, obviously, you were not there when he was arrested, because he was arrested in March of 2021. Were you familiar with his case at all, or did you know anything about his case?
No, I only became familiar with the cases that were still open, and you know, there had been no arrests made. So it was a little data that predated my time even in Daytona Beach office.
Gotcha. So then something interesting happened on your journey here. You said that you were appointed to this Joint Terrorism Task Force. Now, specifically, that put you right there under the directive of, was it Washington specifically, to chase down, issue warrants, arrest, make arrests, interviews? Explain what was happening as that related to January 6th and how that caused you to be pulled off of the child trafficking exploitation cases that you were working.
Well, the FBI has made no secret about the fact that they want to throw everything they possibly can. So that includes man hours. They obviously came to the conclusion within my division that they wanted to apply, you know, my 8 hours, 10 hours a day to domestic terrorism. And because of this voluminous quantity of these January 6th cases, that they saw fit to reassign me to it. The way that those cases are being handled, though, and that's essentially the crux of my whistleblower disclosure, is not consistent with the FBI rules. And the rules that I'm very familiar with my background coming from Indian reservations, where, you know, I opened up hundreds of cases and was very, you know, brought them from beginning to end, and really saw that that what was going on with January 6th is not consistent and was setting ourselves up for, you know, a challenge in court if it's a righteous prosecution, and just on its face, from my perspective, a due process concern. You know, I think there could be a civil rights crime that's actually occurring.
Specifically, what are those FBI rules that you think that they were violating in their directives at that time?
Well, the best way to understand it is that January 6th happens in Washington, D.C. It would stand to reason that Washington field office would open up one case for January 6th. Instead, they decided to open up separate cases for each subject, which is allowable. Now I'm talking about the Domestic Investigation Operations Guide, the DIOG. That's the rule book in the FBI. And specifically Appendix J is what sort of establishes case management processes. So you should open up one case. You should open and investigate it from Washington. If you need, you know, bad guy happens to be located in Daytona, they could send a lead to our office that they need us to perform any sort of duties. That would be the regular way to do things. Instead, they opened up separate cases. That is allowable. Then they told the field offices to essentially become the offices of origin for each one of these cases if the subject lived in our area. So if bad guy lives in Daytona, now the case is open separately and it is run out of the Jacksonville field office. Again, this is still within the rules, very atypical. Where the huge departure came was there's a task force that's operating in Washington field office, which is essentially overseeing these cases, giving directives to us, even though we were the case managers, the case participants, and our offices were the offices of origin, when the rule specifically spells out to us that we are solely responsible for overseeing the investigation.
Was there a specific case or a specific order that you received that finally led to you, either your suspension or you finally coming out as a whistleblower? What kind of give me that progression as it happened?
Well, I asked the guys who were on the JTTF with me because it was just alarming to me that this was going on. And there was a few things that they said that really concerned me. When the rubber met the road for me the following summer, that was the first opportunity that I actually had to arrest or conduct a search warrant for any of the January 6th subjects, which takes us then again back to why was that lag in time? It was because, you know, we were sitting in limbo waiting for Washington to decide if we wanted to go forward with an arrest and a search or if we were going to be allowed to close it. Again, we're not allowing the individuals who were assigned as the case managers in the office to actually make that decision or make that determination or even presentation to a federal prosecutor. It was always being run through Washington, D.C. But in my experiences and asking the guys, why is it being done this way, I was told it was to get buy-in. They were told from headquarters. And buy-in to me could have a couple meanings. One is Washington, D.C. doesn't think that its field off agents are doing a good job unless their name is on the piece of paper at the top, which is a pretty macabre view. But what stands to reason is more likely is that the FBI essentially has budgets for case openings and statistical accomplishments around the country. So by opening up January 6 cases, separate cases for every single person, and spreading them around the country, you're essentially letting the bosses of every field office who are senior executive service, SES, meet the metrics that are spelled out for them each year. And those are tied to their compensation. They get bonuses for essentially having a certain, the standards that they established for themselves the prior year. How many domestic terrorism cases are we going to have open? How many international terrorism cases? How many violent crimes are we going to have open? How many arrests are we going to make? A huge slew of list of check marks. There's a demand in this country politically for domestic terrorism that is vastly exceeding the supply. This was an easy way for multiple years now, the last three, that they're going to be able to have all these bosses in positions of authority check the box on domestic terrorism.
Now, when you say that the demand exceeds the supply, or the supply exceeds the demand, whichever one you said, what I'd like clarification on is how much of this demand was directly related to January 6th cases.
I can only speak to what was happening in my division, but when I got moved over, started to look at what number of terrorism cases that we had open, and it looked like 3/4 of them were January 6th cases. So essentially, you've 3x'd the number of cases that you would have had, because those cases should have been run through Washington, D.C., Washington field office. They shouldn't have been in the Jacksonville pool of available cases that they were working. And now you have essentially half of the workforce, because the FBI is pretty evenly split between national security and criminal matters. Half your workforce is working on ghost cases or cases that they really are not going to be, you know, making any sort of decisions on. We're waiting for directives from outside of our control. And then you start to ask questions about, well, if the directives are coming from Washington, D.C., and they could have just opened those cases up themselves, why did that happen? One is the compensation, and two is to backfill this statistical narrative that has been presented before the American people for the last few years, where the president, the attorney general, the FBI director, any talking head can get up and say that there's a tremendous rise in domestic terrorism around the country, and it's spread all around. And they have the numbers to back it up, because the FBI is the aggregator of all the criminal data, and nobody's really going to dig deep into those numbers because this bottom line number has served so tremendously. And they can say, well, look, that case is assigned to El Paso and that case is assigned to Cleveland, even though those are subjects that were in the Capitol on January 6, 2021.
So what was the specific moment, incident, or case that caused you to hit the wall that you're up against right now?
So I had a couple of experiences that were really alarming to me. One was I was directed to go and interview somebody who an anonymous tip came in from out of state. They said that this individual was assaulting police officers on the Capitol. And there was a facial recognition analysis done from Washington. There was a phone GPS analysis was done, all negative. So I essentially had an anonymous tip and was told, you still need to go talk to this person. Talked to this gentleman very briefly, identified myself. Were you in the Capitol on January 6th? He said, no, that was the day of my son's funeral. And that was when I had this moment of, the process we are doing is the punishment for people. And he might have been lying to me, but might not have been. The other one that I felt, though, that was more significant was I sat in on an interview with a January 6th subject, a gentleman who traveled to the Capitol, watched President Trump's speech, walked over to the Capitol. And then he's now sitting in a law office with us, and he's retained an attorney, which is not free. And he's explaining to us, I stood outside, there was an open door. I asked the Capitol Police officer if I could go inside. This gentleman was a dual citizen. He'd never been to Washington, D.C. He wanted to view the architecture inside the Capitol. He went in. There was no damage done. We had him on surveillance cameras just walking in and then leaving. He apologized for taking a free brochure. And then told us, and his lawyer asked us, where do we stand with this? And we had to say, we don't know. It's out of our hands, even though essentially our office is responsible for this case. And
no, that's an interesting question. I hate to interrupt you because, and we'll circle back to this as well. But when the FBI and the agents are doing an interview with a suspect, we'll call it, and then they tell you at the end of that interview that this is out of our hands now. This is going to be handled by DC or some AUSA somewhere is going to make that decision. Is that the truth? Is it out of your hands? Or are you responsible for making that first and initial recommendation?
We certainly participate in the recommendation, but the ultimate decision rests with the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, we present a case and they may ask for more work to be done on it. They may accept it. They may flat out decline it. They have to make resource decisions on their own. And I've sat in many, many of interrogations where I talked to the subject. And again, this was, you know, derivative, or this is what's going on with January 6th is atypical. Mm-hmm. I have arrested over 150 violent criminals in my career in the FBI. Not once did I have to use a tactical team or a team of 30 agents with full body armor. I sat and I talked to some people who committed some heinous acts. And I said to them, look, the decision to charge you is not up to me. That is going to be up to the U.S. Attorney's Office. However, if they decide to charge you, I will let you know because you've been cooperative with me. We have a relationship here. I'm not going to bang on your door at 6 o'clock in the morning and pull you out of bed. I can have a police officer contact you. I can call you on the phone and have you surrender because the FBI is a professional law enforcement agency. It prides itself on bringing somebody into custody using the least amount of force necessary to do it safely. So for this gentleman, and I don't know what happened with this case, it would be completely acceptable for us to contact his attorney and say, look, he's been charged with a crime. He needs to surrender himself, you know, tomorrow or whatever. But that's not what's been going on. Again, back to the process being the punishment. Instead, they're driving a SWAT Bearcat armored vehicle up on the person's front yard at 6 o'clock in the morning and waking them up out of bed and throwing flashbangs. And these were other concerns that I had. And I said, look, we're really lucky to this point and around the country, essentially, that, you know, we haven't come up on an individual who's decided that, you know, look, I'm not going quietly today.
Right.
And now we have a Ruby Ridge scenario where it was completely avoidable, even if the person obviously disagreed with being charged with a crime. They could certainly surrender themselves peacefully. And that's just, you know, another factor that led to my ultimate decision that I didn't want to participate with January 6th.
I happen to have interviewed a couple out of Tampa who were charged or were investigated basically for what I call the glorified trespassing charge of the Capitol that day. I know that's not the legal or technical term, but it's what I call it. And this particular couple did exactly what so many have done before, just like the gentleman you were talking about a moment ago. They came up with the crowd that day after watching the president's speech. They saw a flow of humanity going inside the Capitol. Hey, the doors are open. They weren't present for when the doors were open, regardless of who opened whatever door they went through. They did go through the door. They spent 15 minutes or so inside the Capitol. They did the tourism thing with their cell phones and they left. No damage, no violence, never even saw any. They went home. They were very soon thereafter, it was like February, they were contacted by the FBI. They went in for a voluntary interview with their attorney, just like this other gentleman. At the end of that particular interview, they were told exactly the same thing. This is out of our hands. We have no idea what's going to happen here, but we will tell you because of your cooperation that if the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office decides to go forward with prosecution, that we will contact your attorney and then you'll be brought in. You'll be processed with the U.S. Marshal, blah, 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 blah. Stand before the judge, make your initial plea, and then that's how it's going to go. 10 months went by and they were swatted unexpectedly with no call to their attorney.
And were they, was there a search warrant executed at the residence too?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which again is, are you searching for evidence of a crime that happened long ago? What sort of evidence are you seeking? And especially for somebody who's represented, there's no reason why you couldn't communicate to an attorney and say, look, we need them to surrender the beanie cap that they were wearing that day. And if they don't, then now they have an additional charge to deal with.
Now, isn't part of what your hesitancy was in terms of, and I'm going to ask you a question about this in a little bit, about disobeying orders potentially, wasn't that something to do with an order to participate in some sort of SWAT operations on misdemeanor offenses? Is that correct?
No, the SWAT team in my scenario was going to be used for somebody who was charged with a felony.
Okay.
I explained to them that even though it was a felony, this individual had said, if you need anything from me, just let me know. Mm. In the interview that I had read, I hadn't been the interview had happened before I even became involved in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So now we're talking about something that was over a year ago.
Wow.
Where we were just sitting in limbo. And another thing that really hasn't been discussed is so many of these cases have dragged out for so long. The FBI has to justify having a case open. So you can't let a 90-day period elapse without taking some sort of investigative action or justification for not, if you're waiting on the attorneys to plead it out, you can't really do anything. But some of these cases were active and we were waiting to hear back from Washington, D.C. We were essentially papering our files, what we call it. On the way home from work today, I'm going to drive by the subject's house and say I did surveillance so I can document that I did surveillance on a domestic terrorist subject.
How many January 6th cases were open at the time that you were transferred to the Joint Terrorism Task Force?
In the entire FBI?
No, just in your office.
In our office, I think there was probably a dozen or a half dozen, something like that. I mean, they had explained to me they had done a lot beforehand. I came on board. There was an initial surge, obviously, after January 6th, where all these leads and came in and tips came in. But at this point, they were getting to the very end of those initial tips. And then when I actually approached my supervisor with my concerns, one of the things he told me was, look, I can't have you say no to this because we're expecting another second wave of January 6th cases to be coming forward because they're going to start charging the individual who stood on the grass outside as being in a restricted area, which now we're seeing is going to be happening.
Yeah, well, the funding has just been allocated for that through this omnibus bill.
Yes.
That's got me concerned, which we'll talk about in a little bit, because as I said, I told you earlier before this started, I have my own unique experience on January 6th. I'm one of those so far unindicted, uncharged potential defendants as an independent journalist who was there that day. I have done the FBI interview. My attorney actually received notice from an AUSA out of the Philadelphia office and this was in November of 2021, that I would be charged with, or she said to my attorney, your client will be charged within the week. And that's been now 14 months ago, I guess. And we've not heard back from them since.
They were probably too busy with the Mark Hawk case.
Probably so, but I am fortunate because there are other independent journalists who have been charged who didn't know more than I did, and there are others who have not been. I know quite a few. I've talked to quite a few who have gone through the FBI process, the interview process, have been threatened with prosecution, who have not had that trigger pulled yet. So we don't know whether I'm going to be in this next batch of funding or not, but we'll find out soon enough. All right, so now take me through the process that happened after you started verbalizing your hesitancy to participate in some of these cases or arrests, warrants, that sort of thing. Let's just kind of get to the crux of that, because that's really when your troubles begin.
Yes. So we had, we kept waiting. We kept having these operations that were sort of loosely scheduled and then they get called off. And eventually word came out that both the Jacksonville division and the Tampa division were going to do simultaneous arrest search operations. So at that point I thought, look, there's too many moving parts here. This is going to happen. And I had already resolved that I was very uncomfortable and just sort of held my breath, crossed my fingers that we were not going to charge these guys. It was self-preservation at that point. I'll own that. But when word came out that that was going to happen on a Wednesday, the prior week is when I made my decision that I was going to talk to my immediate frontline supervisor, sat down on Friday with him before this next week, and expressed my concerns about these practices that were going on, and my concern about the process being the punishment with SWAT. And he was actually pretty supportive on a couple of accounts. You know, he said, look, I'm approving these cases every 90 days and my people aren't putting anything in them. But at the same time, he said, look, you don't have the choice. You have a long career ahead of you. Do you really want to make this decision? Take the weekend and think about it, because I'm going to have to refer you up the chain of command. Did that over the weekend, told him on Monday, look, I don't want to participate. I really don't. We have a wire going on in the office. Can I sit on that wire? Cause that has to be manned. I'll perform an alternate duty. Mm-hmm. He said, look, I'm just going to pass it up. And he'd actually even, tried to recommend that I go talk to counseling services. So then Monday evening, I received a call from the assistant special agent in charge, or one of them. He said, look, I need you to come to Jacksonville tomorrow, to go talk about things. I'm a straight shooter. I said, look, are you taking my gun and badge? Because I'll just leave them on the desk. He said, no, come in. We'll talk. So I drove up the next day, met with, two assistant special agents in charge, vocalized my concerns, that I expressed to my frontline supervisor, as well as bringing to their attention things like, look, in the FBI Academy, we receive very specific training. We take a field trip, for lack of a better term. We go to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. We go to the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. Mm. And the purpose of that day is that they hammer home that these genocides and civil rights atrocities can only happen if nobody stands up, if nobody says, if we all just follow orders. And I said, look, I feel that I took an oath. My oath is to the Constitution of the United States. I think we're violating people's Sixth Amendment rights. I think downstream, we're also violating Eighth Amendment rights. And my oath is to the entire Constitution. And they said to me, look, you have the right to bring forward, you know, these concerns, but you don't have the right to refuse to participate. I said, look, I'm in a difficult situation. You know, I have essentially two conflicting orders. And if that's the case, I have to default to what I believe is the higher authority, which I think is the United States Constitution.
Technically, is that correct? You do have the right to express your concerns about a potential violation of your oath per your training.
Yes.
And at the same time, is that also accurate that even though you have concerns and you have expressed and brought those concerns to supervisor position, that you cannot disobey an order? So technically, are they correct in that?
Well, that's their contention. It still is their contention. I said, I essentially feel like I'm getting an illegal order. If you tell me to go there, I won't come. And that's just, I have a conscientious objection, however you want to phrase it. I feel that this is a violation of my oath of office and I need to take a stand on this. And they said, okay. Then afterwards, within about 4 hours, they emailed me and gave me a directive. And they said, you are ordered to not go to work tomorrow. You're ordered to stay home, stay away from the office. And then on your timesheet, you will put that you were absent without leave. So essentially, I contend I never had the opportunity to not go. I was given a directive the day before the operation to stay home, which I complied with.
So is that an order you could have disobeyed?
I suppose if I had showed up to the office, I would have been disobeying their order.
But you would have been disobeying an order to sign an acknowledgement that you were AWOL.
Yes. And
that seems absolutely ridiculous to me.
I'm not a military veteran, but the AWOL designation, I don't think you can be told to be AWOL.
But you were being told to be.
I was told to be AWOL. It's documented in an email to me. And actually, when I had to fill out my timesheet, which is a whole other issue in the FBI, where essentially we fill out these timesheets and we'd have to do it before the end of the debate period. So we're all kind of like guessing. It's a little bit of fraudulent. Mm-hmm. It took me almost half a day to figure out how to put AWOL on the sheet because nobody knew how. I had to make multiple phone calls and I was docked a day's pay and was allowed to return to work the following Thursday, because Wednesday was the operations. So came back to work and then had a meeting subsequent to the following week on the 1st of September with the special agent in charge of my division. She came to Daytona, sat down with me and my frontline supervisor, essentially was a scaled down Cliff Notes version of the meeting that I'd had with her two assistants. And during that meeting, as well as in the meeting with the assistants, there were some very disturbing comments that were made by my executive management that just stood out to me. That was amazing. So the assistant special agents in charge talked about how the protesters on January 6th killed police officers. They said it multiple times during the meeting. And they also told me I had this duty to the FBI, not the Constitution. My special agent in charge.
Is that on the record as well?
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah.
So when you're going through this particular process, are like a typical FBI interview, is there a 302 of that meeting or is there a recorded transcript available? So, I mean, when they said and made the assertions that your obligation was to your FBI orders or to the agency itself and not the Constitution, that's on the record.
So this was a personnel meeting. I don't know if they recorded it or not. I got the impression that they may have been, but in my honest, I'm going to cover my butt. Plus, I really do believe executive management is participating in a civil rights violation. I wanted it memorialized. So I actually surreptitiously recorded the meeting that I had with my two assistant special agents in charge, which is now a point of contention. I had a meeting last week with the FBI Security Division where they alleged that I might have committed a felony because Florida is a two-party consent state. Mm. I voiced to them that I was acting in a law enforcement capacity so that there's actually an exemption for that. So that'll be adjudicated, I'm sure, as my process goes forward. But, I got that recording because, and I'm frankly lucky that I did. The statements that they made to me, I think, justify a little bit of my concern about what the FBI has been doing and knowingly doing. I don't have any subsequent recordings with my special agent in charge. That was a pretty brief meeting. It was about 20, 25 minutes, but she said things to me like, never in my 24 years have I seen you behave any behavior like this, and that I need to do soul searching and decide if I wanted to be part of the agency going forward. And she used very loaded language in describing the events of the Capitol. She told me that the people tried to seize our Capitol and seize our democracy. But that was, to me, at least in my experience with her, because she'd been the special agent in charge for less than a year, relatively new, but it was very clear to me and some of the things that she'd put out that she definitely leaned left on her political ideology. So I don't doubt that she honestly holds those beliefs.
But these superiors in that meeting were also alleging that multiple Capitol Police officers or MPD officers were killed on January 6th. Is that correct?
Yes, my assistant special agent in charge, Colt Markovsky, said that he asked me, do you think the people who killed police officers shouldn't be held accountable? And when I explained to him, well, that didn't happen. The most high profile one was Brian Sicknick, and it was determined that he died of a stroke. He told me that I really need to go back and review the facts. So
were you able to offer a retort to that and say, maybe
I said, you might no, I, go back I, and review I, the facts? I said, I'm fairly certain of the facts. I follow the case, and that's been widely publicly reported that right. That was what the medical examiner revealed. So, but again, now we're talking about political ideology versus ambition. And certainly for Asak Markovsky, I have it on authority that before he was in an acting role, he was temporarily assigned to that role because it had been vacated, but he had assumed that he was in the supervisor of the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Jacksonville. And multiple people told me that he had voiced concerns about the January 6th cases and the legitimacy, what's really going on. But then as soon as he got that, company man role and got promoted, at least in a temporary way, and in a role that he made no secret about that he wanted permanent, that's when he really started to voice enthusiasm for what's going on, or at least support for it. And that's, I think we're seeing that around the country. And that's why you keep hearing about these accounts where supervisors are saying that this is our September 11th. Mm. And not to say that what happened on January 6th compares to September 11th, but just the vast and importance that's revealed to have been within headquarters at the FBI. This is people, that's 20-year case. This is the first time in their case in their career they have a chance to jump on a case and claim that they had a managerial leadership role on a large scale case, which is really good for their ambitions and careers.
Right. So what was the trigger moment that made you decide to take the risk of going public with this and essentially becoming a whistleblower? And did you actually go through the process of seeking federal whistleblower protection?
When I resolved that I just didn't want to participate in that. And from that meeting that I had with the gentleman who, you know, was getting interrogated for walking into the Capitol and just following what's been going on, in Washington, D.C. in the districts there, as the cases have proceeded, where it just doesn't seem like anybody's getting a fair trial. I just sort of had that wash over me over a matter of months, and really I just didn't have an opportunity to take a stand before that August. Mm-hmm. So I'd made the decision ahead of time, and when the actual order came out that I said, look, I'm not going to do it. That was my time to take a stand. Actually going to my frontline supervisors the week before, that constitutes a protected whistleblower disclosure according to law.
Just going to your supervisors.
Yes, okay. It did. But then I actually drafted a full whistleblower complaint after I was suspended indefinitely in September. It was on a Monday. I was suspended first thing in the morning. And then in the ensuing days, I sort of drafted this complaint in conjunction with my attorneys and submitted that to the Office of Inspector General and the Office of Special Counsel. I gave it to multiple members of Congress. So that is an actual document of record, which I was hoping that the OIG and OSC would take under consideration. Unfortunately, though, that they've declined to investigate.
So while under supposed whistleblower protection and you're suspended, is that without pay?
Yes. So when I was officially suspended indefinitely without pay on September 19th, I was allowed to exhaust my vacation time that I'd accrued. Mm-hmm. And continue to receive a paycheck. But once that elapsed, no more paychecks. So it's now day 134 since my suspension. Mm-hmm. I'm suspended indefinitely, and it is a security clearance suspension. It's not a personnel action. And that is really the way that the FBI is skirting whistleblower protection. They find any way they can to pull your security clearance and say it's an issue of national security. So the exigency justifies pulling it. You can't work as a special agent without a security clearance. You can't be paid. You can't have workspace. Whereas if they went through the inspection division route, you could continue to work and receive a paycheck while they investigated and ultimately took an action. So this is sort of a hack around that process. It's exposed with the rationale for suspending my security clearance. They provided three reasons. They said my unwillingness to participate in the raids that were going on, which, as we talked about, I really didn't. I actually complied, or at least arguably did. And they said that I improperly accessed documents on the Bureau system, which were the employee handbook and documentation about the disciplinary procedures. And I did that actually, and I told them I did it. My attorney asked me to access those documents for him, mm-hmm. because he wanted to be able to defend me in a personnel matter. So I got them for him.
And, how can you inappropriately access the employee manual?
I used a blank jump drive that the FBI furnished me for child pornography investigations and saved them on there and then emailed them over to my attorney. But they said that jump drive was not approved to access the system that I was on.
So it was just the mechanism.
Correct. Okay. I could have printed out the 800 documents, I guess. Right. I didn't do that. And then the final one was in the week prior to my indefinite suspension, again, ASAC Markovsky called me and asked me to participate in a security awareness briefing. I asked him, I was unfamiliar with it. He said that, well, you get a briefing and you signed documents when you first got hired and we get annual training, but we want you to do it again. And I said to him that it sounded like I was being singled out because if this is a training that everybody gets, why am I repeating it? But if it's going to be a personnel matter, I wanted to have an attorney. And he told me I wasn't allowed to have an attorney. I said, well, if you can check on that for me, then, and let me know, then I'll come. And he said, okay. And they said that I refused to participate in the briefing and walked me out 3 days later. So I never got the follow-up.
So you were required to surrender your badge, your gun,
yes.
And you were basically walked out of the field office. Is that what happened?
Yep. First thing on a Monday morning, I had to call my wife and tell her to come pick me up.
What was the response of your fellow agents there out of the field office you worked at?
I haven't heard anything from them.
Nothing. You've got no response.
No. I'm fairly good friends with a task force officer who's now actually left from being a task force officer, and he works as a detective for a sheriff's office. And he and I are shooting buddies, so we've gone to the range and just socialized in that way.
Right.
But no agents from the office have reached out to me.
What about the other whistleblowers around the country? There's been, I think the last numbers I've heard are 24, 27, something like that. And of course, more famously, Kyle Serafin is the more documented or interviewed yourself at this point.
Serendipitously, Kyle Serafin did an interview with Dan Bongino that was released the exact same day that Miranda Devine spoke about me on Tucker Carlson. It was the exact same day. Kyle reached out to me. He's got a pretty extensive network that now I've become a part of. And so we're talking about a matter of 8 to 12 hours, and we were in touch. And I think we've spoken every single day since then. Yes. And then we've pooled our mental resources, and he's launched this fledgling podcast that he has. And I appeared pretty regularly with him on that. And we have both worked now with this forthcoming weaponization of federal government against the American people subcommittee that's going to be going on with the Judiciary Committee. And we're just trying to assist them any way we can.
So how many whistleblowers out of the FBI itself are you familiar with right now?
Right now, I've spoken with 4 or 5 firsthand that I know by name.
Yeah.
The others I know have come out sort of anonymously, which is actually in their good on them for their future career prospects, because from what I understand, there might be rules that have been put forth in Congress that will actually prevent protection for individuals who will become known. So
now the FBI is actually known to be rather ruthless towards whistleblowers. We can speculate on why that is, and might be unique among federal agencies, but I would have to assume that that's because of privacy concerns and security concerns, the process, that sort of thing. But they are, and you've actually just become a victim of yet more reprisals. And this is where why I contacted you yesterday for this interview. Tell me a little bit about what just has happened recently.
Yeah, so it goes back to the day I was walked out of the building. They gave me paperwork in the form of a FD-331, where you can request outside employment. Because I'm technically an FBI employee, even though I'm not paid, they have to approve of any employment. I received an offer last week to work for a 501c3. I communicated with the Office of Integrity and Compliance at headquarters, and then also forwarded on my documents to the chief security officer from my field office and on Friday, and said, look, this is a pretty time sensitive. They wanted me to start work relatively quickly. Could this be considered? They got back to me so I submitted that on Friday. They got back to me on Monday and said that my request was rejected. So they expect me to still not be able to bring a paycheck home.
So they rejected you yesterday. That was yesterday.
Yes.
So this 501c3, is it involved in any type of law enforcement or investigative work at all? Is there any crossover with the FBI?
Yes, justifiably, they asked me to work as a fellow for this think tank and essentially do research on federal law enforcement for them.
Okay.
So my resume, I feel like there's a pretty good Venn diagram there where I could qualify for that position. But obviously the FBI doesn't want me investigating its own malfeasances. So they deem that to be an unacceptable career path.
So you could take a job as a plumber.
I am sure I could work as a barista just about anywhere.
and that would be acceptable.
Yes.
With the FBI. Never mind your training, never mind your education, never mind your experience.
I'll add to that. I'm still technically an employee. The Privacy Act entitles me to access my training records. And I live in the state of Florida. So I was considering getting a private investigator license in order to avoid having to do the apprentice time or the training time. I could rely on my federal training, and the FBI has refused to furnish me those documents as well. And they actually told me that I need to do a FOIA request for my own documents, which would prove unsuccessful because of the law enforcement exemption. So again,
you're married with children and you're being denied the right to earn an income utilizing your experience in education.
Correct.
And is that legal? What does your attorney say about this?
Well, they've brought what's gone on to the Inspector General, and the Inspector General is investigating investigate my whistleblower complaint. They are not doing that. They said that I can bring that internally to the FBI to investigate itself, but the Inspector General's office can also investigate whether or not I am a victim of, as a whistleblower, getting an adverse action taken against myself. So my lawyers have been in touch with the OIG's office and are hoping to at least facilitate the transfer of my training documents, and then just making them aware that they're really limiting my ability to earn an income.
Wow. So let's take a moment here to circle back to my own particular experience with the FBI, because I've been fascinated since that interview took place and the whole process that went on there with actually the behind the scenes process that you guys go through. And it's because I'm going to learn something right now, I hope, that I've had questions about. And I'll tell you an interesting aside here. The two agents that interviewed me here in North Carolina, Agents Noyes and Agent Doss, they weren't playing good cop, bad cop on me. One of them was just more aggressive than the other one. And the less aggressive of the two, I've always wanted to talk to him. I could see from body language and in his eyes that he was opposed to what was going on. That's just me reading body language. And I've on several occasions spoken to my attorney and told him that I really would like to just get an off the record sit down coffee with Agent Doss. And my attorney absolutely will not let me do that. And you agree with my attorney?
No, exactly. No.
Well, let's
talk off the record conversations with FBI. Agents.
Well, and the thing is I didn't expect it would be off the record on his side. It would be off the record on my side.
All right.
And because I am curious about the process, I'm also curious about how an individual like himself thought about what he was going through that day, having to proceed with, ostensibly an interrogation of a independent journalist who they know. They actually thanked me in the interview. They actually said at the beginning of the interview, thank you for not doing any violence and not assaulting any law enforcement that day. We've seen you go in. We've seen you come out. We've watched you through the entire process. We know that you were just there with a camera and a microphone, and that's all you did. But we have to do this. We're under orders to go through this interview process with you. And so they both of them had stacks of file paperwork on the table in front of them, because obviously they had pulled up my years of writing. And so they knew everything about me politically. They knew everything that I had written about this event, because I didn't hide anything. My videos from that day have been used in the HBO documentary, New York Times documentary, Epic Times documentary, and many other news agencies have used my videos from that day. And I, a week after January 6th, I posted my first article, which was 9,500 words long, about what I saw that day and what I witnessed as a firsthand, witness to the event itself. And that was similar to so many other journalists, mainstream media journalists, as well as other independents who were either stringers for somebody else on paper or some news service that day. And I obviously felt like that I was being selectively targeted, probably because my conclusions about the day didn't necessarily fit the approved narrative that was being spawned at the time. But it was about 9 months after the event before they ever even contacted me. So when the agent contacted me and called me at 10 o'clock in the morning, they actually knew that I was speaking at an event in a suburb of Washington, D.C. the next evening. And so they said, we see that you're going to be in DC tomorrow. I was wondering if you'd have a couple hours in the afternoon to sit down with us. And I said, yeah, I'd probably have time to do that. But unfortunately, my attorney wouldn't be able to be there. And he's like, oh, yeah, we can wait till whenever your attorney's available. So we scheduled that meeting and or the interview. And when that date arrived, my attorney and I showed up about 15 minutes early. The two agents welcomed us at the door through the security, you know, process. And we sat in the lobby and they said, we have a problem. And they said, we don't know whether we're going to be able to do this interview with you today or not, but we'll know. Can you give us 10 minutes and we'll be right back. So they went back behind the secure doors and it took them about a half hour though, before they came out and they said, look, here's the problem. We can't interview you today. What's the problem? The problem is that because you're a working member of the media, the press, we have to have special written permission from the U.S. Attorney General's office even to talk to you.
Yeah, you're called a SIM, a sensitive investigative matter.
So I didn't know that protection existed for me. So consequently, we had to wait over a month before the U.S. Attorney office contacted my attorney. They negotiated the terms under which I would be interviewed. And I was given a proffer sheet where basically said that nothing could be used against me in that investigation or in that interview in the court of law unless I perjured myself. I said, well, let's rock. I'm not going to lie. I'm just going to tell you what I saw and what I did. That's all I have to talk about. So that's what we did. The interview was rescheduled, lasted about 2 hours. As I said, one of the agents was a little bit more aggressive than the other one. I was very verbose, even though I was under, you know, receiving counsel from everybody not to do this, not to even submit to it. My own attorney sitting next to me, he didn't want me to. But I felt like I had nothing to hide and I went for it. And so I asked as many questions of them as they did of me that day. But the questions that I've not been able to ask is what the process is that happened afterwards. Now, just before I get into asking you what that process is, one more thing. In the first interview, my attorney had gotten him to agree to allow me to record that interview myself. And they did. That interview didn't take place. In the second interview, part of the agreement was that I couldn't record that interview. But even though I had already signed the paperwork saying I wasn't going to record that interview before it began, I asked again and I pressured them. I pushed them. And I said, why can't I record this interview? What ultimately is probably said, well, the problem is that, you know, we have to worry about our own security, our own safety. We do, you know, undercover work all the time. And I said, well, I'm not talking about a video interview. I'm talking about just a voice interview. And what if I sign a paper right now saying that I'll never identify who you are and such? And they're no. And then one of the agents actually got angry with me and said, why are you pushing this now at the time when you've already agreed not to? And I said, well, I am a journalist and I would like to, A, record this myself, and B, hold you accountable because I don't know what you're going to do with this this particular interview. And they said, and they pointed up at the wall where all the equipment was, you know, embedded in the wall up there. And they said, this is all being recorded. And if it's ever needed, you'll have full access to the transcripts and to the recording itself. I said, okay, so let's proceed. So the interview took place 2 hours later. Everything was jovial. We were kind of laughing about certain things that we had talked about. We stood up and then they went through that conversation that I talked about earlier that had happened to the couple in Florida. They said exactly the same thing to me. They said, look, it's out of our hands. He said, if you are charged, you're going to get the four basic misdemeanor charges that everybody is getting hit with, you know, for the glorified trespassing tourist that day. So you're only going to get those charges if it happens. But that's out of our hands completely. We'll turn that over to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They'll make that decision. And then if and when they do decide to go forward, we'll contact your attorney. You'll come in, submit yourself, go through the process at the U.S. Marshal's office, get fingerprinted, have your picture taken, go stand before the judge, and then you'll be released on your own recognizance because of your cooperation. And then about a month later, my attorney received notification from AUSA in Philadelphia who told him in an email that your client is going to be charged within the week. And that was the week before Christmas, week before Thanksgiving 2021. And we've never heard from them again since. So 13, 14 months ago, the last time we heard from them. Mm-hmm. So with that said, what then took place after they dismissed me and sent me out the door that day? What happened in that process?
they just documented their meeting with you in a 302. You know, the contemporaneous notes that that we all heard about that Jim Comey wrote, jotted down after a meeting with President Trump. So it's called a 302. You document, you know, this is interview, the details, the you know, the questions that were asked, the information that was provided. They put that into the case file and shipped it up to Washington, D.C., where the task force there, I'm sure, looked at it. And I think it's interesting that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia contacted you because the prosecuting office is in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why the Philly office would be involved in the arrest portion. If they were going to be conducting a search warrant at a location within their area of responsibility, that office would be involved with that because they would have to work with the magistrate judge in that area. But certainly a threat from a Philly prosecutor, I don't know why. Unless the only other thing I can think of is the task force that's in Washington is so staffed with all these temporary attorneys that it may have in fact been a attorney working remotely from Philadelphia and doing work on behalf of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, her signature line on her email actually said she was part of that joint task force.
Okay.
And I just assumed it was a manpower issue. They just didn't have enough attorneys in D.C. to handle the overload of what was going on.
Sure. And that makes sense. But yeah, the document that they write is pretty straightforward. If there's a recording, that's supposed to be submitted as electronic surveillance evidence. That's burned to a disk, put into an envelope, and then kept and housed. And then if there's going to be charges, there's the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to draft sort of a charging document that should be presented for a grand jury, and the grand jury is to decide whether or not they're going to indict. But you know as well as I do, you can indict a ham sandwich. So if the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to bring charges, you'll be charged, and then hopefully there'll be people of their word and actually communicate with your attorney.
How much influence do those two agents have over the decision that that particular U.S. attorney makes?
If this was any other case, they'd have more input than they're going to have on January 6th case. And just from my personal experience.
And that is because?
And that's because I worked with specific assistant U.S. attorneys in my entire career, the same ones. I knew them. They're, I would even call them my friends. I mean, we would send them text messages like, hey, buddy, how you doing? And after you develop a relationship, you know, with them and working and you've worked, you know, over time and had lots of cases, they will take your, the merits of your case, you know, a lot more than somebody who they don't know. And they'll actually, you know, ask you questions like, what, how important is this case? Cause it's kind of borderline. I don't know if we have the resources or if it's worth our us. And, you know, I, like I said, I arrested 150 subjects. So there were cases where I went in that were really, from the U.S. Attorney's Office were, yes, we have to take that. And then there are other ones that were like, well, look, this could be referred to the local, or in my case, it was tribal law enforcement. It could be referred to the state authorities. And I would say, look, the sentencing guidelines on this case federally are a lot more harsh. This is a person who has a long criminal history, I think, and just make the case that why I wanted the case. And more times than not, they would say, well, we respect your history and your insight knowledge because we're not out there and we don't know these. Mm-hmm. So they'd be more inclined to take it. But with this task force, they're the affiance on the, on the
right
criminal complaints. So those agents in North Carolina, they might have a phone call with those folks, but ultimately the individuals who are drafting the affidavits are working out in Washington, D.C. They're just looking at that 302 and did it answer the questions they wanted answered? And if it checked the box on enough of them, they're going to use this template that they use. And they've used to such an extent now that you can actually see charging documents that have clear typos on them in the first paragraph.
Mm, yeah.
And I think there was the recent one that just came out last week, where the individual swore that they were a special agent. And then later in the first paragraph, they said they were a task force officer. So it's clearly just a document that gets passed around to all these people. And they're not even doing the scrutiny of the first paragraph. The federal judges are doing the scrutiny.
So I've read through intensely dozens and dozens, I mean, very specifically studied dozens of these January 6th charging documents. And then I've skimmed through 200 or 300 others. And always they announce themselves as the FBI affiant at the beginning of that. But you're saying that they didn't, the affiant himself or herself did not necessarily write the charging document
for
the
whole
12, 16, 18 pages?
No, and you can tell because the stock language that's related to January 6th, there will be this long description and every single person is going to have the exact same language. So it's a copy and paste, but you know, I'm not innocent of doing that. I mean, I would take my own charging documents that I drafted and then just update them for a new case that was similar, you know, language for the court's purposes, because it's legal language is not English. You want to have that. And you know, I would update it with, you know, the new facts of the case, but the way that these January 6th cases, so much of those documents is this stock language that in the FBI would call it a pony, essentially just a go by. It's a template. Mm-hmm. Hey, do you have the pony for the January 6th case? Yeah, send it over. And I just change the name from John Smith to, you know, Steve Friend or to whatever I need. And then you're supposed to, you know, include what this individual did. And that could be one paragraph. The rest of it is just stock language.
Well, I am familiar enough with some of these other independent journalists who have been arrested and charged. A couple of them have had the red dots on their chest at 6 o'clock in the morning. They have been swatted. And in those particular cases, having read through their documents as well, these were individuals who were just as nonviolent as I was, just as professional in their behavior as I was that day. And in some cases, they were interviewed prior to their arrest. In some cases, they weren't. They just one day woke up to that loud bang at the door and, you know, the bullhorn telling them to come out. What would you have done if you had been in a situation like or similar to mine, where you had, after the interview, told the person being investigated that because of your cooperation, you're not going to be swatted. We're going to call your attorney. We're going to have you come down and, you know, voluntarily submit yourself for processing. And then after going through that conversation, then you received an order to go kick the door in at 6 a.m. What would have been your response?
I think at this point, I probably would have had a similar reaction to what I did on the cases that I had. And that was honestly how I felt then with those cases. And certainly the one gentleman was accused of, you know, assaulting officers, but I felt like we had a relationship with them. The guys were represented by attorneys. There's nothing that says that we can't use a vast array of tools at our disposal. And I brought that forward. I said, look, you could be something simple. It could be a phone call. It could be, we're going to issue a summons. You surrender yourself. If you want to take it up a notch, it could be we send the local sheriff's office to knock on your door because you see that uniform. That's an individual you may know, recognize, especially if you're in a small town. And they say, you know, hey, we got a warrant for you. You have to come in. You could mobilize a surveillance team to interdict somebody. You know, they stop off at the gas station, and when they're pumping up, suddenly three vehicles block them in. They come in. It's tremendously safe. My whole thing is, yes, should be done safely. It should be done with the least amount of force necessary, but that's not what's happened. It's we're going to make a point. We're going to send a message, and the process will be the punishment. Even if you get acquitted, which is not happening, but if you get a probation, a slap on the wrist, the fact that you had to live through this ordeal is going to leave its mark. And that is not the role of the FBI. We are not the executioner.
So let's get into the politics of it a little bit then, because last week, Senator Rand Paul said, you've probably seen this, that in his estimation, the top 10% of the leadership of the FBI needs to be completely replaced in order for that agency to be salvaged. How do you feel about that?
I think you could probably put another zero on it.
You think that the entire agency needs to be eradicated?
I mean, I'm pragmatic in my worldview. I don't think that any politician, no matter how much of a diehard, is going to come in if they were the president and say, we're disbanding the FBI. I think that would just take a level of political courage that I don't see on the landscape these days. However, I think that there are some very logical and reasonable reforms that can be done. And I think that you can make the case pretty simply if you just do a little bit of reverse engineer thinking. So if you owned a stock that was worth $100 and you came to me and said, Steve, should I sell this stock? I would say to you, well, if you had $100, would you buy it? And because you think it's going to go up? And that kind of answers the question, should you keep it or should you sell it? If I came to you and said, you have $11 billion. I have this law enforcement agency as it's presently constituted. Will you give me the $11 billion for it? I don't think that anybody who's followed anything that's gone on in the last few years in the FBI would say the FBI doesn't need to have major reforms in order to justify the funding that it has. And I don't think it should have the funding to begin with. I think it's, you know, large swaths could be eliminated. The fact that they're sitting in Washington, D.C. as a headquarters, this is the swamp, which is supposed to be a, you know, an impartial, nonpartisan agency, when we have a $2.5 billion facility in Huntsville, Alabama. I don't know why that can't be made to happen.
Yeah,
there needs to be major reform on the hiring processes. There could be even simple. One of the things that I thought about was, let's just eliminate all possibility that there's a political agenda or there's any nefarious things going on. The people that are organizing and running these cases on January 6th, a lot of them have a national security background. They don't have a criminal investigation background like I do.
Right.
And that's because they graduated from the academy and they got shipped to their field office and right away put into counterintelligence or counterterrorism. But a lot of these cases for January 6th are criminal investigations. They don't know how to bring that case forward. Mm. So why aren't we having new agents come out of the academy and cross-deputizing them with our local law enforcement partners who the FBI claims are the bread and butter of bringing in the cases? And right. You should be sitting in that detective office with these guys who have a decade of investigative experience, and they can teach you how to investigate a forged check or a stolen bicycle, as opposed to we're going to toss you in on the Enron case on your first case.
I happen to be one of those rare constitutional libertarians who believes that there is a place for a federal investigative agency, but not so much on the enforcement side, if that makes sense, if you can differentiate what I'm trying to say there. I believe that if there was a substantial and legitimate reform to the FBI, that the first thing would happen is that this entire idea of the FBI even having SWAT teams would go away. I think that local law enforcement should be handed whatever investigation, even if it's a national security issue, and that they need to decide. As we saw in Waco, had that operation been handed over to local law enforcement, to the sheriff there in Waco, he was good friends, you know, with I'm blanking on his name right now, you know, the main character there at the ranch.
David Koresh.
Koresh. And the Branch Davidian group. And the local sheriff knew that he was not a danger to the community.
Correct.
And had that situation been, if they just handed over, this is our investigation, this is what we think that we know, this is what we think we found, this is what we suspect. Can you take this over and follow up on it, and if necessary, make that necessary arrest at the coffee shop or at the gas station the next morning and bring him in so that we can talk to him. And then that situation would have never happened, and all those children and all those people would not be burned to death at this time. We can list more and more cases like that around the country where that similar situation would have happened if the FBI, the ATF had not had those enforcement prosecute, really, you know, because they prosecuted that event on the spot by their actions. Mm-hmm. And so I think that would be a substantial reform. I'm specifically in favor for a national investigative or federal investigative agency related to national security. But I definitely see that serious reforms. And I will say this, the reason why it needs to be handed over to local enforcement once the investigation is done is because it's impossible to separate the political from the investigation side or from the agency side, regardless of what the agency is in Washington. It's just not going to be an apolitical organization. I don't see how that can happen. It never has been and never will be.
Yeah, I think there's some merits to your points there. I think it, even if that wasn't done fully, it'd say that the FBI retained some sort of, you know, enforcement, as you're saying, you know, like a SWAT team or just even agents that are armed.
Well, I think in the investigation process, you need to be armed.
Yeah. But right. if you're liaising, as you should, with your local partners, and you get out of the mindset that still exists, where it's that diehard scene where they say Agent Johnson, no relation, because they view themselves so high, and then the lowly LAPD police officers, you know, can't possibly, you know, wrap their brains around the, you know, what's going on here. That's not how it works. The guys who are on the ground making cases are the local police officers and sheriff's deputies. When you make them task force officers, I always told people, you guys know that they have more authority than we do. They have state arrest authority and federal arrest authority. Mm-hmm. You know, the federal, with the exception of special jurisdictions like a maritime or an Indian reservation, there's no federal crime for murder.
Right.
Let's just be honest. They have this vast authority that we don't have, and they have local knowledge. And a lot of them, most of them, are from these communities. They have a personal investment in them. So I think liaising with your locals, and like we talked about, you know, if you have even a violent subject, the local law enforcement is equipped to handle it. The FBI is supposed to be there to augment them. If it's a small department or an agency, doesn't have particular resources, they don't have a dive team, and there's a, you know, evidence that's in the middle of a lake, the FBI can come in and help them. That's why we're here. That's why we pay taxes, so that you know, those tools can be brought to bear for righteous reasons. But when the FBI exists as its own, and now with, you know, since the last couple of decades, since 9/11, where there's essentially the priority is placed on intelligence gathering above investigations, now we have a problem. I mean,
let's talk about a couple of other unique intersections I personally have with your world. I had mentioned to this to you before we started recording that I had been working on a child trafficking lead in case from an investigative reporter, news investigation type scenario. And I was following a lead down there and came into acquaintance with some professionals. One of the individuals that I was working with down there spent 20 years as the, let me see if I can get his job title correct. He was a human trafficking trauma expert, in which he had for 20 years worked with the FBI and 150 other law enforcement agencies around the country in that area of expertise. He then introduced me to an actual private investigator who works child trafficking cases as his bread and butter of his job in Houston. So we were introduced, and I was asked to come out with him and ride shotgun with him one night. The first night that I rode with him, before we hit the road, we actually met in his hotel room where he had his base of operation and his computer set up and all of his, you know, surveillance gear and everything that his tools of his trade. And he began to read me into this case. And I'm leaning over and looking over his shoulder. And he had been contracted by the FBI, as he's a private investigator, contracted by the FBI to handle this particular case. This particular trafficker moving girls as young as 13, 14 years old across 8 different state lines from Houston as his base. And I saw the photos, I saw the stamps, I saw all of the documents, I saw the emails from the FBI that basically had turned this case over to him. And then all of the printouts, I actually carried them and flipped through them in the front seat of his truck as we were, you know, executing some of his operations that night. And so I know for a fact that it was a contracted job from the FBI. And the question that I asked is, why would they be handing you a child trafficking case? And his obvious answer was, well, you know, they've got so many other things to do related to January 6th right now. They just don't have time for this.
The idea of a contractor working on a criminal investigation, not even just, hey, look, we don't have the goods here to prosecute it. You know, maybe you can do something on the civil realm. And, you know, I have a relationship with you because you used to be a police officer who I work with, and now you just hung up a shingle as a PI, something like that. But to just have a private investigator working on a federal investigation, to me, it seems extremely problematic. I've never come across that. But I will tell you that when I transferred to Daytona Beach with the understanding I was going to be working these child pornography, human trafficking cases, and only had a chance to do that for a few months, I was on that phone call or listening in on the phone call, and where the assistant special agent in charge told my supervisor that I was going to be reassigned to domestic terrorism, and that all of the child pornography cases were going to be considered a local matter going forward. And I can also tell you that there was an entire squad that worked in my headquarters city in Jacksonville that focused on child pornography investigations. It was disbanded. Two agents were left to work those matters. Everybody else was rolled into a violent crime squad. So it wasn't just, you know, one person who was moved over for resourcing. It was, we're going to reshuffle the entire agenda priorities within our division. And unfortunately, one of the most egregious and heinous things out there, this, these child pornography and human trafficking cases, was put to the bottom of the pile. And I, you know, I have my own, you know, opinions on why that is. I think that, you know, obviously there's a political agenda with January 6th. I also think that the FBI is really good at getting headlines for itself, but they want to do headlines in a way that makes the public smile.
Yeah.
And the public smiles when you come in and you have, you know, a stack of fentanyl pills that you've, you know, busted this huge drug ring on. But if you say, look, I have a pedophile here who has 14,000 images, people don't want to think about it. They don't want, they, it's just, it's really gross. We would all as a society rather just overlook it and just on to the next drug dealer or, you know, organized crime or something else that's, you know, that they're going to write movie scripts about and have TV shows about. There's not a lot of child porn, Hollywood action films.
Well, let's talk about one more unique intersection that we have. I was looking at your Twitter feed just today in preparation for this interview, and I saw that you had posted a reference to the New York Times reporter, Alan Feuer, who has spent a lot of time covering a lot of January 6th related cases, trials, that sort of thing. I know Alan. Alan and I have spoken many times since the Oath Keepers trial, the first Oath Keepers trial. That's where we met. He and I were the only two reporters who actually heard with our own ears the revelation that there was going to be an FBI confidential human source testifying in that trial. That testimony did not happen. But we were the ones that learned that this particular testimony was going to come from a CHS. And I reported it at 9 o'clock that morning on my Twitter feed. And then he wrote an entire story. Of course, obviously, the New York Times having much more coverage than I get myself. He created quite a controversy. Now, his story was quite accurate. It was very well done, very well written, and it was absolutely accurate. And he protected his source, as I have done myself. And we are the only two individuals that heard it with our own ears. And it caused a firestorm in the courtroom the next day. Judge Maeda was angry, and he called a sealed session where I assume, because he, obviously the press, we were cut off from that sealed session, where I assume that he chastised the attorneys and the defendants that weren't incarcerated at the time for whoever might be in that courtroom that released that information. And there was a lot of follow-up, and there was a lot of, I mean, it was one of those stories that Tucker and everybody else covered the next day. So you had an interesting intersection with Alan Feuer yourself in that the FBI, for whatever reason, apparently turned over your medical records to Alan Feuer in the New York Times.
Well, if you use a little bit of deductive reasoning, I don't think there's any other way to come to any other conclusion. So it was during the Hurricane Ian. I was in Florida. You know, we were dealing with about 40 hours of storms. Electricity knocked out, internet knocked out. Finally got like one bar, and one of my attorneys was reaching out like, "You need to call me now." So I got in touch, and he said, "The New York Times called us and with a request for comment on two issues. One, the fact that you are being investigated for shooting your FBI issued pistol in your backyard. And two is that you're unvaccinated against SARS-2 coronavirus." So a couple things on this. The allegation that me shooting a pistol in my backyard just made up whole cloth, or Mr. Feuer might have conflated me with Kyle Serafin, who had his security clearance pulled because he was shooting on a gun range in New Mexico. And a police officer came up to him and said, you can't shoot here. And he said, well, actually I'm on county jurisdiction, so I can. And the officer left. but that's considered to be unprofessional conduct by the FBI. More likely, they're just upset with him for being a whistleblower and they pulled a security clearance. So maybe somewhere in there, because it was related to shooting guns, maybe Allen thought that that was me. And because he saw my picture that was appeared on Fox News, he thought there was only one person as opposed to two. But more specifically to what we're talking about, he asked about my private medical information. Now, the FBI had everybody attest to their vaccination status in October of 2021. I am not vaccinated. I contracted coronavirus, didn't feel that I needed to be vaccinated. And frankly, in what's come out, you know, since, I'm pretty glad I'm not. Right. But there's no way that he would have obtained that information from any other source. He certainly didn't call me about it. And my attorney pointed that out and said, look, you can't confirm or deny, but if you're in possession of my client's private medical information, I'd like to know where you got that. So the story never actually aired, never went to print. But
really?
That was my first interaction, not my only, but on no occasions has he reached out for comment when he's talked about me in his writing. I think that just sort of is unprofessional. If you're going to write an article about me, I would like for you to ask me for right. comment. But
your attorney did back him down from...
Did. And the story never was published. Now I'm kind of kicking myself. I kind of wish it had. I might have had a nice chunk of change when this unpaid status.
That's right. But I'll tell you what, if you can confirm that he in fact, do you know for a fact that he did receive that information from?
No. I mean, it could have been a bluff, but he called for that fact. And it's consistent though with what I'm hearing and learning about anybody who's been suspended or terminated or is facing discipline. My contention at the time that I had to do this attestation about my vaccine, when I told my wife, I said, look, I think that the FBI is politicized and it's getting a registry of people who are unvaccinated and is going to target them. Mm-hmm. And that has been extremely accurate. Everybody who I've talked to has been suspended. They're all coincidentally unvaccinated. So I think that there is, you know, this quote unquote hit list registry, and a very political FBI is seeking out ways to eliminate people who are not willing to just put the head down and just follow orders.
And humorously, I would say this nomenclature for your organization, the suspendables, was also outed by the FBI or by the New York Times. Was that Allen also?
That was Allen. Yes. He did that in a very complimentary piece to a retired special agent in charge who there was a Office of Inspector General did an investigation of for some sexual impropriety. We made that public. It's a matter of public record. And then Mr. Fuhrer went to this individual or vice versa and wrote a pretty glowing piece about him being a national hero and then having, you know, given the agency all these years of his life and service. But in this article, he mentioned my name, misspelled, and didn't seek comment, and then talked about the suspendables, which we did sort of on, you know, on a lark, just to kind of laugh at our situation. I said, look, we're like the Sylvester Stallone trilogy movie of these retired action heroes. And right. maybe we'll all go to work one day as private investigators and we'll be called the Suspendables.
Suspendables. That's awesome.
And it's caught on. And now that the paper record has it, I think it's got some legitimacy. So we're starting to sell our merchandise to support whistleblowers.
That's fantastic. Well, you've had the Untouchables. Now you've got the Suspendables.
Right.
And thanks to Allen, that name is out there. And was his piece on this other agent as glowing as it was of his piece on Ray Epps?
Oh, I mean, it's splitting hairs in the difference.
I've actually had a discussion with Allen about his piece on Ray. In fact, he called me sitting at this desk one night, and he told me everything that I'm about to say to you, he said, is on the record, and please share it. I mean, he's a believer in Ray Epps and his story and his innocence and his non-participation either with the FBI or any other federal agency. And then on that very phone call, I presented some new evidence that had just come out of Ray Epps being escorted out of that massive crowd. I don't know if you've seen that video from Capitol CCTV, and he's got four people in front of him, four people behind him, and there's as they snake their way through that crowd. So he was not there only with his son and his son's friend, as he has testified to.
No, I don't think he was. I think there's a lot of questions there. I mean, I you know, everything we have so far as is insufficient to form a real accurate opinion. But I think that that's something that, again, he should be somebody who should be subpoenaed to appear before this new subcommittee on weaponization.
I'll tell you what, he'll get harder questions this time than he got the last time.
Yes, yes, he will. And if he's under subpoena, he'll actually have to answer them because with the Republicans in control, they can actually bring down the hammer, as opposed to a Republican even asking a legitimate question and the Democrats having the majority, they wouldn't enforce the subpoena.
Exactly. Well, Steve, I'm not going to hold you any longer. Again, thank you so much for spending this time with me. How do we reach out to, or how does this audience reach out to you either in support? I know there's a Give Send Go. Is that a suspendables Give Send Go? Or
it's a, yes. Yeah, so we have a Give Send Go, that is givesendgo.com/Kyle Serafin. Kyle set that up. It does not go to him, does not go to me. It actually goes to another individual who is, who got a very, very raw deal, and is in quite a bit of trouble, financially, but, should be a front and center person for this new subcommittee.
That link in the description below. But you don't have yourself, you're not fundraising. I mean, you have a family and you have no income right now.
Correct. We don't, but I feel like if people are indeed feeling charitable, there are some better ways that they could put the money. One is that Give Send Go. Another is to empower oversight, which is a whistleblower protection 501c3 that gives legal protection. And then the last one is Win with Cash, with Cash Patel's organization, who's also provided a protection. And you can just reach out to me on social media, follow what I'm doing. I have a book that's going to be published this summer. So that will be maybe a source of income for me. It's called True Blue. That has gone on pre-sale on Amazon as of this week. And I'm on Twitter at @RealSteveFriend and on Truth Social at @Real_SteveFriend.
Okay. Awesome. And I'm going to ask you one last closing question. How many more of you guys are going to come out and help with this process?
If the subcommittee on the weaponization of the government against the American citizens prioritizes what has gone on with the whistleblowers as far as being receiving adverse action for making protected disclosures on behalf of the American people, you will see them come out in droves. And that is why I am encouraging that subcommittee to make this the first issue. I know that there are other things that, you know, that might grab some headlines, you know, if it's a laptop or if it's a classified documents being found in a garage. Those are all important, but I've laid down over the barbed wire. Kyle Serafin has stepped on the landmine for others. If we get the protection that the law is supposed to entitle us to, we have the network that will tell them where the bodies are buried. They won't need the subpoena power or the power of the purse. You will have a willing workforce come forward, because there are still good people behind who want to see the reform that the FBI so direly needs.
Well, based on that answer, I would encourage everyone to call your congressman and let's make this happen. And also based on that answer, I would encourage any other federal agents from any department who have been paying attention to this to examine your own heart, examine your own oath, and it's time to get brave and come out yourself. Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless.